We want our children to have the best chance to live fulfilling lives, but can you keep up with all the books and scientific research on parenting and fit the information into your own philosophy on how to raise kids? Welcome to Your Parenting Mojo, the podcast that does the work for you by investigating and examining respectful, research-based parenting tools to help kids thrive. Now welcome your host, Jen Lumenlund.
Hello and welcome to episode 5 of the Your Parenting Mojo podcast, which is called How to Scaffold Your Children's Learning. Now, when I started to talk with people about the idea for this podcast series, one thing that came up over and over again was the idea of supporting our children's growth and development. And one friend of mine put it particularly concisely and articulately by asking, how do I know when to lead and when I should step back and let my daughter lead? And I've taken quite a journey on my learning on this topic and wanted to share a bit of that with you today. Those of you who are becoming regular listeners might recall that the idea came up in my interview with Professor Tara Callahan in episode 4, related to developing creativity and artistic ability in young children. She talked about the process of scaffolding children's learning, and we'll dive a lot more into that today. So there are 3 theorists on the topic of learning and development whose work I want to discuss briefly. One of the main child development theorists that I think a lot of people have heard of is Jean Piaget, who was born in Switzerland in 1896 and died in 1980. And Piaget believed that children pass through 4 stages of development that are pretty much biologically determined. The physical brain development has to happen first, and then the learning follows. And Piaget's approach to child development was very popular in the US for many years, although a lot of researchers now regard it as incomplete and flawed for several reasons. Firstly, because most of his theories were developed through detailed observations of his own 3 children, which was a bit of a small sample size that isn't really representative of any larger population. And then also, research has shown that children don't automatically move on to the next stage of development when one stage is completed, like Piaget thought. The environment has a role to play as well. And Piaget tended to think that children didn't mature until much later than we now believe is true. So a second famous theorist is B.F. Skinner, who was an American psychologist who was born in 1904 and died in 1990. I was actually really surprised at how recently these guys were still alive. Skinner's approach was called radical behaviorism because he thought there was no such thing as free will. We basically make decisions in response to external stimuli, and thinking and perceptions and unobservable emotions don't determine a person's behavior. Instead, it's stimulus in equals response out. You train the child and the child develops. It's as simple as that. And there have been many criticisms of behaviorism, with a variety of theorists coming from different perspectives who don't believe the brain is a black box in which nothing really happens. And yet, I'm actually surprised to find that many of the common practices that we use in parenting and also in schools are based on behaviorist principles. So, for example, saying good job, we say it because we think the child won't do the thing that we're doing unless we say good job. It's a reward for a behavior. Stickers are another way of rewarding. And timeouts are a way of punishing for behavior that we don't want to see. And then finally, there's a third theorist named Lev Vygotsky, who was born in Russia in 1896. And he died of tuberculosis in 1934 at the age of 37. So a lot of his work wasn't finished. But he still had time to make some really major contributions to our understanding of child development. And in contrast to both Piaget and Skinner, Vygotsky believed that learning plays a major role in development. So learning actually leads development. The child's brain structure changes in response to learning, and as children receive instruction from adults or even from more experienced peers. So Vygotsky had 2 ideas that are really central to the way that I and many other people today think about child development. The first of those is called the zone of proximal development, and the second is called scaffolding. And so we'll dig deeply into both of those. So firstly, let's talk about the zone of proximal development, which Vygotsky defines as the distance between the actual developmental level, as determined by independent problem solving, and the level of potential development, as determined through problem solving under adult guidance or in collaboration with more capable peers. Which sounds kind of complicated, but it's easiest if you try and visualize it as a horizontal line broken up into 3 equal sections in your mind's eye, and I'll give you an example. So my 2-year-old daughter, Karis, has a set of 10 cuboid-shaped crayons that fit into a cardboard box, and that box goes inside a second cardboard sleeve. So the crayons only fit in the box one way. And from about age 15 to 19 months, she would tip all the crayons out of the box and try and put them back. But she could not figure out how to get them all back in again. So her skill at getting crayons out of the box was over in the left third of your horizontal bar, which represents her ability to do something without the help of others. She didn't need my help to get the crayons out. When she was 6 months old, she might have needed my help to get the crayons out of the box, but at 15 months, she could do that perfectly well independently. Now, over in the right third of your horizontal bar is the task that she's not able to accomplish, even with the help of someone more knowledgeable, which is to put all 10 crayons in the box in the one way that they will fit when she was about age 15 months old. Even if I reorganized the crayons she'd already put in the box and asked her to figure out how to put the remaining two or three crayons in, she would usually put one crayon on top of another and try and press it really hard as if to make it fit in the nearby empty space. So on the left is the task that she does really well without help, and on the right is the task that she can't do even with help. Now the middle third of that horizontal bar represents the task that Karis can accomplish with the help of a more knowledgeable person, whether it's me or an older child or whoever. And at 15 months, if I put 9 crayons back in the box, leaving one empty space of the right size, she was usually able to figure out how to put that one remaining crayon in the box. That task of putting one crayon in the box by herself was within her zone of proximal development, or ZPD. She couldn't get all the crayons in the box by herself, or even 2 or 3 of the crayons, but she could get that last crayon in the box if I helped her by putting the rest of them in. Now, over time, I back up that level of support and put fewer and fewer crayons in the box each time before asking her to take over. And after several months, she was eventually able to put all the crayons in the box by herself with no support. And I should say that this was not a totally linear process. She actually put the crayons in the box for the first time while we were traveling in Italy, and I wasn't even in the room when she did it. I came back from the kitchen to the living room where she was coloring to find all the crayons back in the box. And sometimes even after she'd done it that first time, she still needed help when she put the first crayons in the wrong way. But now more often than not, she can put them in without help, and her zone of proximal development has moved on to other tasks. So that process of providing and then gradually withdrawing support that I was doing is called scaffolding. And Vygotsky said that the child is actively constructing knowledge for herself, but the social environment that I provided in that example is the scaffold or the support system that helps her to build new competencies. Now, I should say that this whole scaffolding thing is a very Western, and I suppose Russian, since Vygotsky was Russian, thing. David Lancy, who's becoming a bit of an old friend by now, if you've been listening to the first few episodes of Your Parenting Mojo, reminds us in his book, The Anthropology of Childhood, that in Western educated, industrialized, rich and democratic, or weird for short, society, parents and adults generally take every opportunity to interact with and instruct children, even when they are patently unmotivated or too awkward and immature. The term scaffolding may be used to describe the process whereby the would-be teacher provides significant assistance and support so that the novice can complete a task that is otherwise well beyond his grasp. Elaborate scaffolding is rarely seen elsewhere. Nobody wants to waste time teaching novices who might well learn in time without instruction. Play provides an alternative to adult scaffolding. Now, I have to think Lancy's being a bit tongue-in-cheek here because, as I already mentioned, someone who is in the teacher role wouldn't attempt to scaffold a child who is unmotivated or too awkward or too immature. That would be like trying to scaffold a child who's all the way off on the right of our bar divided into three parts. The task is so far out of the child's realm of competence, there's just no way to bring the child to competence, even with assistance. But the rest of Lancy's point remains that in many cultures, scaffolding is neither needed nor used. And instead, children tend to observe and copy their peers and parents in tasks like weaving and making arrows. Guatemalan Mayan parents, for example, are much less likely to structure learning situations for children. They expect children to take responsibility for their own learning through observation in adult activities. And the adults use demonstration and monitoring as tools to help children understand tasks. But it has to be said that we aren't really a weaving and making arrows kind of society. Well, maybe some of us are. I actually like to weave and knit. Isn't it true that because ours is a more complex society, our children need more help to make it in the world? Professor William Greenough at the University of Illinois helps us out with some more new terminology that's relevant here. He distinguishes between experience-expectant behaviors and experience-dependent behaviors. The first one, experience-expectant behaviors, are the kinds of things that are programmed to unfold in our bodies, such as our eyesight and our speech and even our athletic ability. Our brains expect to have the experiences that will develop our eyesight and guide us to use language and move our bodies around. And so the brain grows as it naturally encounters these experiences in the environment. And there have been cases where children who were severely deprived of human contact, and we're talking about the kind of deprivation where someone's going to jail here, not because you didn't buy them My Baby Can Read DVD set, where they're never fully able to make up the skills they weren't developing in what is known as a sensitive period. And other studies have shown that deaf children of hearing parents can have some cognitive delays that deaf children of deaf parents don't experience, because the deaf children of hearing parents had to go through a period where they weren't exposed to language being used fluently while their parents learned sign language. But in general, these abilities will develop in children at some point, pretty much no matter what we do as parents. But the other kind of behaviors, the experience-dependent kind, are the kind we're probably talking about scaffolding. Now, these are things like tying your shoelaces and reading and learning a second language. And we might want our children to learn to do these things, but they're certainly not required for survival. And I think a lot of parents have heard about these sensitive periods and windows of opportunity and worry that if they aren't taking advantage of their child's sensitive window, then they'll miss out on something that everybody else's child is getting and maybe won't get that spot at Harvard. But it turns out that the sensitive window that we fear is so short is actually pretty long. One study uncovered the critical result that the ability to learn a second language is indeed related to the age at which the person begins learning that language, and that people who start learning English as adults never achieve the same proficiency as if they had started pre-puberty. But if you dig even further into the results, you find that people who arrived in the United States before the age of 7 achieved performance equivalence with a person who had always lived in the US. For arrivals after that, there was a linear decline in performance through puberty, and after that, there was no longer a correlation between age, but instead there were differences in individual performance that actually weren't found in the other age groups. So the important part here is that, assuming the results for English learners hold true for native English speakers learning another language, the window to learn a second language to native proficiency seems to start to close at around age 7. So parents of toddlers have a good deal of time to play with on this. And whether the child is a Chinese-speaking nanny or not will probably have no bearing at all on his later ability to learn Chinese to a native level, and he could still pick it up perfectly adequately several years later. And there's really no critical window that slams closed for learning the language even after puberty. You can still learn a new language today if you want to, although perhaps not to native fluency. Another review of related literature says that critical periods are the exception rather than the rule, and instead we should think of them as sensitive periods because they function across a broad and flexible range of time. So instead of worrying about the specific timing of certain activities, we should pay more attention to the overall quality of the child's experience beyond the traditional birth to 3 years that are often thought as the critical window. Finally, there may be no critical or even sensitive window at all for activities like chess and gymnastics. We just can't generalize the sensitive periods that exist for evolutionarily important behaviors like bonding between mother and infant and say that similar sensitive periods exist for every learned behavior. Anyway, now we've done that little aside into experience expectant and experience dependent behaviors, the point I want to make is that number one, firstly, we don't necessarily need to scaffold experience expectant behaviors like language learning because the child's going to pick it up anyway. And number two, we can scaffold experience-dependent behaviors if we want to, but it's really a choice that we make as parents about what we believe to be important in our child's experience and how we want to teach it to them. The thing to remember is that providing your toddler with a loving environment with adults who respond to his needs is the most important thing you can do to give him a good start in life. So if you do choose to do it, how do you scaffold learning? There are 5 key components. The first is that the child is engaged in an interesting and culturally meaningful activity in a collaborative way with another person. In other words, the child probably wants to learn, either because she's inherently interested in the process and the outcome, and/or she sees the social value of learning the thing, whether that value is spending time with a parent or because all my friends can do it. And the with another person part is important too. While I suppose it's impossible that an instructional book or video can play this role of a scaffold, researchers have shown that people learn best when they're working with others when they're trying to solve a problem. And I can attest to that having spent an awful lot of time watching videos to learn new programs over the last couple of weeks to get this podcast into your ears. So the second concept is the idea of intersubjectivity. And that means how two people arrive at a shared understanding of a common task. So as I was reorganizing the crayons in the box for Karis, I was reminding her that we had solved the problem previously and wondering aloud if the crayons might fit if I helped her to turn a few of them around. The third component is the warmth and responsiveness that characterize the interaction that maximizes the feeling of confidence. So the adult watches closely to anticipate when the child might struggle, so the adult can offer just enough support for the child to be able to proceed by himself. And when the task is concluded, the adult can acknowledge the achievement, which is not to say that you have to go overboard with effusive good jobs, but usually just a quiet, you did it, will suffice. Fourthly, you want to keep the child in his zone of proximal development. And you can do that with the types of activities you make available and also by breaking tasks down into their component steps to make them easier to understand. And the adult should provide moment by moment help as the child needs it and then withdraw support as the child's competence increases. And finally, the adult and the task should promote self-regulation, which means the child is in control of the activity rather than the adult. And the adult should only intervene after the child has had some chance to struggle. So if the adult steps back and allows the first chance to try what strategies he thinks might be appropriate, instead of always stepping in to say, this piece goes here, the child's learning and self-regulation will increase. Now, a variety of experimental studies have shown the benefits of scaffolding children's learning. A pair of researchers named Roberts and Barnes found that the best predictor of 4 and 5-year-old scores on intelligence tests was parental scaffolding and the use of questions that gave children opportunities to think and speak about the task. And on the flip side, directive and commanding phrases from mothers were negatively related to children's performances. A study by Professor McCarthy found that children do well at a spatial construction task when their mothers have previously taught them how to divide the task into manageable sections, and when the mothers have practiced reducing parental assistance when the child no longer requires it. And finally, a Professor Pratt found that some students were able to shift their level of support during math problems depending on the child's need moment by moment. So providing help when the child needs it, although not so much help as to take over the task, and then backing off as the child begins to succeed. And that use of shifting behavior predicted gains in the children's learning of math. So just to reiterate as we wrap up, scaffolding is a very culturally specific practice. And I don't want to leave you with the impression that it's the essential key to children's learning that maybe your kids have been missing out on if you haven't been doing it. It's also really important not to push it too far. If you do push your scaffolding attempt too far, the child might get frustrated and just give up. And younger children might just appear to ignore you. Now, I see that in Karis when I ask her why she thinks something happened. Now, at 2 years old, she's able to tell me what has happened in real life or in a story, but if I ask her why she thinks it happened, she just ignores me. And I still ask her every couple of weeks or so to test whether she's developed that ability yet, but I don't press it on a regular basis. And instead, I back off a bit and talk with her about what's happened in a story or in real life. So scaffolding is just one more tool in your toolbox to help you support your child's development. And I hope it helps you understand a bit more about when you can lead and when it's best to step back and let your child lead the way. Don't forget that all the references for today's episode are on yourparentingmojo.com under episode 5, Scaffolding Children's Learning. Thanks for listening. We'll speak again soon.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Your Parenting Mojo. Please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes and sign up for our mailing list at yourparentingmojo.com to receive a free gift, 7 relationship-based strategies to support your children's development while making parenting just a little bit easier on you. For more respectful, research-based parenting ideas to help kids thrive, we'll see you next time on Your Parenting Mojo.